The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome. It looks like a great crowd this evening. All the applause don't have to be for me. We really want to applaud Daniel. Just a few words, and I jot down a few notes so I wouldn't forget. For those of you who were here earlier, kind of everybody stole my thunder. Daniel, I am honored to be a part of this and to welcome Daniel James Brown. The book is fantastic. It is more than just a rowing book. It is a book about courage, hard work, and the American spirit that embodied all of those people, that all of those men that were trying for the gold in the 36 Olympics. Dan grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area. He now lives in Seattle. He's taught writing at San Jose State and Stanford. We won't hold that against him here in this city, but yeah. before he became a full-time writer. His focus on the events and the history of the events are just compelling. He writes a wonderful visual story of the people and the events. And as I thought about my rowing career and how as I read the book, I was just overwhelmed with the wonderful memories that this book brought back to me, how it affected me as a competitor and as a young man. I mean, it truly was amazing. As everyone, I don't know whether everyone knows this, The Boys in the Boat is currently a bestseller in the New York Times bestseller list, on NPR's bestseller list, and on the Los Angeles Times bestsellers list. So I encourage everyone to read it. And so without further ado, I want to introduce Daniel James Brown.
Thank you, Fred. Boy. Fred thinks he's honored to introduce me. It's the other way around. I was just so thrilled to hear that he was going to be here this evening, let alone introduce me. I didn't, I have to confess, I didn't really know his story till a few weeks ago when he emailed me, and I got curious, and I read about him, and it's just absolutely inspirational. So thank you very much, Fred. Let me start by telling you how I came to write The Boys in the Boat. It was almost 6 years ago now that my neighbor, a lady I knew then only as Judy, came to me. It was actually after we have this homeowners association meetings that are absolutely awful, dreadful things where we bicker about what color you can or can't paint your mailbox or... And this was a particularly awful one. But Judy came up to me afterwards, and she said that her father was living with her at her house, and he was under hospice care, and he was in the last few weeks of his life. And she was reading one of my earlier books to him, and she wondered if I would come down and meet him. So, of course, I did. I went down the next day, as I recall, and I met... Joe Rance. And Joe began to tell me, well, we talked about that earlier book for a while, and then he began to talk about growing up in the Depression. He had a particularly poignant and heartfelt story to tell. He had a very difficult family situation. If you haven't read the book, I don't want to detail it, but he had a very, very hard childhood during the Depression. And then he began to talk about how he had come to row for the University of Washington and how that had affected his life. And then he began to talk about how he had, he and his crewmates at Washington had gone on to row for a gold medal in Berlin in 1936, rowing against, amongst others, a German and Italian boats in front of Hitler and Goebbels and Goering and all the top Nazis. And as Joe was telling me this story, I just became absolutely mesmerized. And I noticed that as he was talking, from time to time, he would tear up. And he was tearing up whenever he started talking about any of the other young men who had rowed with him. And at the end of the conversation, or towards the end of the conversation, I didn't go down there looking for a book topic, but I just spontaneously, I just thought, this is so, such a great story. It really should be told. So I said, Joe, can I write a book about your life? And he shook his head, no, you can't write a book about my life. He thought about it for a while, and he said, you can write a book about the boat. And I didn't really know what he meant by the boat at first. I thought he meant the shell, this beautiful cedar shell, the Husky Clipper in which these guys rowed in Germany. But then he gave me to understand that he meant the other boys in the boat, but he meant something even bigger than that. He meant this thing that they had once become together 70 years before in Berlin, this almost perfect thing that they had once become. And he said, that you can write about that. It was very important to him that I write not about any one of them, including him, but that about all of them and what they had done and what they had become together all those years ago. So that's the spirit in which I set out to write the book. Now, the climax of the story that Joe told me that day, of course, was this gold medal race in Berlin. And I know some of you have read the book and some of you haven't. It's no secret at the beginning of the race that they win the race. I can tell you that much right now. They win the race, they win the gold medal. But for those of you who haven't read the book, just to give you a sense of what they were up against that day, since it is sort of the climax of the story, they really had a lot of work cut out for them. When they took to the water, they were at Grunau, southeast of Berlin. As they say, Hitler and all the top Nazis were there. There were about 75,000 fans there, mostly German. Germany had won the first five races that day. They'd won gold medals in the first five rowing events of the day. And the crowd was pretty much in a frenzy. They were chanting Deutschland, 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 giving Hitler Nazi salutes. The American boat and the British boat were assigned the outside lanes, which meant they were rowing out in the middle of the longer sea, exposed to a very stiff sort of quartering headwind. And the German and Italian boats, the two fascist states, were assigned the two innermost lanes. And they were protected the entire way of the, virtually the entire way of the race course. On top of all that, Don Yum, the stroke for Washington, was deathly ill. He'd been in bed for days, actually. And Al Ulbrichtsen, the Washington coach, had brought along two substitutes, and he kept putting the substitutes in, and the boat just wouldn't go right. And actually, the night before the gold medal race, the other eight boys went to Ulbrichtsen, who was not a man who was easy to confront. They went to him and they said, Coach, you have to put Don Yum in, sick or not. We got to have him in the boat. Just tie him to the gunwales if you have to. He's got to be in the boat. So he did. The next morning, they took him down to the shell house. They stretched him out on a training table till just before the race. They bundled him in blankets and coats, and then they took him down, put him in the boat. And when the race started, that gold medal race, on top of everything else, the American boys didn't hear, they were out in the windy part of the course, as I say, they didn't hear the start signal. They didn't see the flag drop. They didn't know the race had started until they saw the boats to their left surge out ahead of them. Don Hume tried valiantly, but he was just not responding at all to Bobby Mock the coxswain's commands. So by the time they got out into the middle of the longer sea, maybe 1,000 meters into the 2,000-meter race, they were dead last and in absolutely desperate straits, and the Germans and the Italians were streaking down the inside lanes. And that's where I'm going to leave it. you can read the rest in the book. But the last, I mean, as I say, you know who wins the race, but what's extraordinary is how they won it. The last couple hundred meters of that race, I think, were just absolutely extraordinary. And it was great fun, I have to say, to writing, great fun to write about it. So the book is obviously largely about rowing. But as Fred said just a moment ago, it's not just about rowing. It's a much bigger story than that. It's really a sweeping story, and it's really a story ultimately about the human heart that plays itself out on the stage that is rowing. It's a story about nine boys who come together to forge something much larger than the sum of their parts. It's a story about one boy, Joe, who must learn to survive by depending only on himself, in his childhood, and then must learn its opposite, that to succeed, he has to learn to trust others. It's a story about craftsmanship and grace and pride and the pursuit of an ideal. It's a story about grit and determination in the face of overwhelming odds, about punishing pain and psychological devastation and ultimate jubilation. It's a story about the American genius for defying the odds. It's a story of democratic idealism come face to face with fascist cynicism. Really, in pretty stark terms, it's at its most fundamental level, it comes out to be a story of good versus evil. And in the end, I think it's a story that helps define that whole generation of Americans, the generation that Tom Brokaw called the greatest generation, the generation that for most of us was our aunts and uncles, or fathers and mothers, or grandfathers and grandmothers. One of my purposes in writing this book really has been to honor them. You know, rowing at this level, the Olympic level, is hard. It's extremely hard. And the demands of rowing, the demands these boys went through, the physical and mental demands they went through to become the oarsmen that they did, humbled them. They learned their limitations. And the humility they learned from that experience, I believe, is the doorway through which they were able to come together and trust one another, open up their hearts to one another, and became what they became. And for me, this story is kind of a metaphor for that whole generation. I believe that just as the harsh demands of rowing humbled those nine young men, the ravages of the Depression humbled all of them and their contemporaries. That generation of young men and women learned together, confronting the Depression and the terrible privations of the times, that there were forces at work in the world that were more powerful than they were. And that taught them humility. And humility, I believe, again, was the gateway through which they were able to reach out to one another, trust one another, come together, climb into a boat together, set forth on rough water, and not only get through the Depression, but wage and win World War II. So, as I say, for me, the story, and I didn't really come to this realization until I was done writing the book, but as I stand back at it and look at the story, for me, the story of these nine young men is kind of a metaphor for that generation. Now, you can read and enjoy the book, I think, without buying into that. It's nowhere explicitly in the book, but it's sort of my takeaway, one of my takeaways from the story when I stand back from it. Now, there is plenty of rowing in the book, and I'd like to read you a passage that has to do with one of the races that these guys rowed. And I picked this passage partly because I think it helps us remember just how wildly popular rowing was in the 1930s. In the 1930s, 100,000 people or more might turn out for a regatta at Poughkeepsie or in Boston or even out in Seattle on Lake Washington, 70,000, 80,000, 90,000 people would turn out for a regatta. The regattas were sometimes broadcast nationwide on radio networks. Famous or exceptional oarsmen would find themselves on the cover of national magazines. So sport got a lot of coverage. Huge crowds came out. There was a lot of excitement in those days surrounding the sport. And I picked this passage partly because I think it helps capture that. But I need to sort of give you the setting here because I'm picking this up partway through. This is the summer of 1936. We're in Poughkeepsie, New York. It's the the annual Intercollegiate Rowing Association Regatta, which in those days amounted to a de facto national championship. And pretty much to nourish their dreams of going to the Olympics, the boys from Washington needed to win that race. And to win that race in particular, they had to beat California. California had twice before gone to the Olympics, had twice before won gold medals. Al Ulbrichtson of Washington was absolutely obsessed with getting Washington to the Olympics, partly because he had a very intense rivalry with Kai Ebright, the coach at Cal. So it's that race. There are other schools involved, but everybody expects it to come down to California, most likely to come down to California and Washington. It's 6 p.m. and dusk is falling when the varsity race goes off. This is the four-mile race. Ulbrichtson, Washington's coach, is watching the race unfold from an observation train that runs parallel to the river. I should tell you that Ulbrichtson is a very stern man. He's legendary for his reticence. He was called the Dour Dane or the man with the stone face. He did not like to show emotion. He did not like his boys in particular to see him showing emotion. Now, he's told Bobby Mock, the coxswain, to race from behind, but by no means to get more than two lengths behind. And Mock, by the way, is in the habit of sometimes lying to his crew about where they are in the field in order to keep them motivated, has in fact been lying a good deal throughout this race. And he has also been holding the boat almost four lengths back. And Ulbrichtson, watching from the train, is absolutely beside himself. And that's where I'll pick it up here. On the train, Al Ulbrichtson had all but given up. "They're too far behind," he muttered. "They're overplaying their hand. We'll be lucky to finish third." Ulbrichtson's face was ashen. It seemed to have turned entirely to stone. He'd even stopped chewing his gum. In the lane nearest to him, California had powered back out in front, rowing beautifully. With a tiring field behind them and less than a mile to go, Cal was in a commanding position to win. Kai Ebright, it seemed, had somehow outwitted him again. But if anybody had outwitted Al Ulbrichtson, it was his own coxswain, the short kid with his own Phi Beta Kappa key. And now he would show his hand. Suddenly he leaned into Don Hume's face and bellowed, "Give me 10 hard ones for Ulbrichtson." 8 long spruce oars bowed in the water 10 times. Then Mock bellowed again, "Give me 10 more for Pocock." Another 10 enormous strokes. Then a lie. "Here's California. We're on them. 10 more big ones for Mom and Dad." Very slowly, the Husky Clipper slipped past Columbia and began to creep up on Navy in second. Someone on the train idly remarked, "Well, Washington's picking up." A minute later, someone else called out much more urgently, "Look at Washington, look at Washington, here comes Washington." On the train and on shore, all eyes shifted from the leaders to the 8 white blades barely visible out in the middle of the river. Another deep guttural roar began to rise from the crowd. It seemed impossible for Washington to close the gap. They were half a mile from the finish now, still in third place, still 2 lengths back, but they were moving. And the way they were moving compelled immediate and absolute attention. In the boat, Mock was incandescent. "Okay, now, now, now," he barked. Don Hume took the stroke up to 35, then to 36, then to 37. On the starboard side, Joe Rance fell in behind him just as smooth as silk, and the boat began to swing. The bow began to rise out of the water. Washington slid past the middies, as if the Navy boat were pinned to the water. Cal's coxswain, Grover Clark, glanced across the river And for the first time since he'd left it behind the starting line, he saw the Washington boat sweeping up on his stern. Stunned, he bellowed at his crew to pick it up, and Cal's rate climbed quickly to 38. Mock hollered at Hume to take it up another notch, and Washington went to 40. The rhythm of the California boat seemed to waver and then grow erratic. California and Washington careened into the last 500 yards, storming down the corridor of open water between the spectators' boats. People in rowboats were standing up now, risking a dunking to see what was happening. Some of the large excursion steamers began to list toward the center of the river as people crowded their rails. The roar of the crowd began to engulf the oarsmen. Boat whistles shrieked. On the float in front of Washington's shell house, Evanda Mae Calamar, the crew's cook, waved a frying pan over her head, whooping and urging the boys on. In Washington's press car, pandemonium broke out. George Farnell of the Seattle Times shoved his press credentials into his mouth and began to devour them. Tom Bowles commenced beating a stranger on the back with his lucky old fedora. Royal Brougham was shouting, "Come on, Washington, come on." Only Al Albrechtson remained motionless and silent, still riveted to his seat, his eyes cold gray stones locked on the white blades out in the river. Joe Williams of the World Telegram stole a glance at him and thought, this guy has ice water in his veins. With the finish line looming ahead of him in the gathering dark, Bobby Mock screamed something inarticulate. Johnny White in the number three seat suddenly had the sensation that they were flying now, not rowing. Stubb McMillan desperately wanted to peek, to glance over toward lane one where he knew California would be, but he didn't dare. In number six, over the crowd noise, Shorty Hunt could hear someone on a radio yelling frantically. He tried to make out the words, but all he could tell was that something terribly exciting was happening. He had no idea how things stood, except that he still hadn't seen the California boat fall into his field of view. He kept his eyes locked on the back of Joe Rance's neck and pulled with his whole heart. Joe had boiled everything down to one action, one continuous movement, one thought, the crew's old mantra running on through his mind like a river, hearing it over and over, not in his own voice, but in George Pocock's crisp Oxford accent, mind in boat, mind in boat, mind in boat. Then in the last 200 yards, thinking itself fell away and pain suddenly came shrieking back into the boat, descending on all of them at once, searing their legs, their arms, their shoulders, clawing at their backs, tearing at their hearts and lungs as they desperately gulped at the air. And in those last 200 yards, in an extraordinary burst of speed, rowing at 40 strokes per minute, Washington passed California. With each stroke, the boys took their rivals down by the length of another seat. By the time the two boats crossed the line in the last vestiges of twilight, a glimmer of open water showed between the stern of the Husky Clipper and the bow of the California Clipper. In the press car, the corners of Al Ulbrichtson's mouth twitched reluctantly into something vaguely resembling a smile. He resumed chewing his gum slowly and methodically. Standing next to him, George Pocock threw back his head and howled like a banshee. Tom Bowles continued to flog the back of the fellow in front of him with his old fedora. George Farnell removed the well-masticated remains of his press credentials from his mouth. In Seattle, Hazel Ulbrichtson and her son Al Jr. pounded the glass top of their coffee table until it shattered into dozens of people. And up on the automobile bridge, Mike Bogo had the distinct pleasure of setting off seven bombs in rapid succession. In the boat, the boys pumped their fists in the dark night air. For a long while, Ulbrichtson just sat there, staring into the darkness as fans came rushing through the car, congratulating him and slapping him on the back. When he finally stood up, reporters crowded around him, and he said simply, "Well, they made it close, but they won." And then he elaborated, "I guess that little runt knew what he was doing." Thank you. The bomb reference, by the way, in Poughkeepsie during the regattas, they had somebody stationed up on the railroad bridge, I think it was, or the auto, I don't remember which bridge, but he would set off, detonate, what they called bombs, some kind of explosives, the number of explosions corresponding to the lane number of the victorious boat, because it was the only way fans could quickly tell who had actually won a close race. So let me move towards a conclusion here by saying that I write books largely because I find that there's no better way in the world to really understand something than to write a book about it. And I really enjoy peeling back the layers of a topic until I get down to the essential truth of it. And I knew precisely nothing about rowing when I began this project. And so over the last 6 years, there have been a series of revelations for me, large and small. And I just wanted to mention a couple of them, some of which won't be revelations to those of you who row, I'm sure. But one revelation that I came away with was just how improbable these particular Olympians were, just how much the deck was stacked against them. These were working-class kids who were pretty much consumed with simply struggling to find a next meal in the middle of the Depression. They grew up in Washington State in logging camps and mill towns and on dairy farms and fishing towns. To do what they did, they had to take on the Ivy League sons of bankers and lawyers and senators and even presidents. And then they had to go on and take on the most elite rowers in the world, probably at the time, British boys from Cambridge and Oxford. And then they had to take on literally a hand-picked, all-Aryan Nazi crew in Germany. So I think when you read the book, if you do, and get to know these boys and their just how humble their circumstances were, you get an appreciation for what how long the odds were in some ways stacked against them. I also learned that rowing is an extraordinarily difficult thing to do. It's really almost brutal physically. It didn't take long to discover that, not by doing it myself, but by simply being around it. It becomes pretty clear pretty quickly. But I also came to realize more slowly that rowing is really beautiful. And I think it was particularly beautiful in the days when they rowed these beautiful cedar shells on waterways that in many cases were quite pristine. But in addition to the beauty of watching a race, I can't tell you how many times rowers have come to me and how many times these nine boys talked about it in their own letters and conversations, talked about having what were almost spiritual experiences out on the water. And in the book, this side of rowing, this sort of sense of spiritual togetherness and elevation of life that rowing brings for some people. In the book, this side of rowing is embodied by George Pocock. For those of you who aren't familiar with the name, just very briefly, Pocock was the English-born gentleman who built these beautiful cedar shells on the Washington campus. And ultimately, by the mid-30s, he was building them for pretty much every crew program in the country. He was a consummate craftsman. He was also a fine oarsman. And in both his craft of boat building and in rowing, he believed in seeking the ideal. He believed in striving for something higher than winning. He certainly believed in winning. He wanted to win every race. But he also wanted his boys to reach beyond that, to find something higher in their lives. And for Joe Rance in particular, but for all these nine boys, that filled an enormously important void. So every chapter in the book begins with a quote from Pocock, because he was sort of the philosopher of the crew. But let me just read one of them, because it sort of sums up what a lot of the others say. He said, "It's a great art is rowing. It's the finest art there is. It's a symphony of motion. And when you are rowing well, why, it's nearing perfection. And when you near perfection, you're touching the divine. It touches the you of yous, which is your soul." And as I say, that attitude towards life, as well as towards rowing, becomes a really important part of the story for a number of these boys. And then finally, the number one thing that I came away from the story with, the biggest revelation I think I had, was just how extraordinary the bond was that these nine men formed with one another during the 3 years that they were together, 3 or 4 years in some cases, but then how that bond endured for the rest of their lives. As you know, many of you, CRU demands an almost absolute surrender of the self to the common effort of moving the boat through the water. And to row really well at this level, each rower must move in almost perfect physical and psychological rhythm with all the others. And really, all of them must become extensions of one another and ultimately meld into one perfect thing. And that's what these 9 boys did, and they never forgot it. For the rest of their lives, they never forgot it. When they were old men together, when they were old men and they began to die, their families became like one family. When there were only 2 of them left, Joe and Roger Morris, Joe and Roger, I witnessed this myself, Joe and Roger would get on the phone for an hour or two at a time, and they would say almost nothing. I mean, it was really interesting. Joe would say something about the weather, and Roger would answer, and then they'd just be silent for 3 or 4 minutes, and Roger would say something. And it was just amazing to watch, but the reality is, it was this way between all of them. They just needed to be together. The experience they had in Berlin that summer bonded them together in a way that they never forgot, and they hung on to it for as long as they could, remembering that one perfect thing that they had once been part of. So that's the end of my prepared remarks. But usually the most interesting things at these events, or many times, comes out of the questions. So what we're going to do is I'm going to ask you, if it's all right, to raise your hand if you have a question, and somebody will bring you a microphone so I can hear you and we won't have to repeat each question. So anything's fair game. Yes, sir.
I don't need that. Please wait for the microphone. Okay. thanks for coming tonight to see us.
Sure.
I'm curious as far as sort of a tactical approach, if let's say you wanted to be a writer. You know, obviously a lot of the gentlemen you interviewed were older in life and may not be with us anymore. So how did you go about sort of telling this whole story? In other words, Was it all interviews? Was it newspaper articles from the internet? Was it ultimately a bunch of little crumbs? And then you, as the author, say, here's my story, reader, and I'm going to tell you through my eyes.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I should say that the moment that the other 8 families found out that I was writing a book, they came to me in Moss with boxes of letters and clippings and photographs. And they sat down with me for, I must have 100 hours or more of interviews with them, talking about their dad or their uncle or their grandpa. Very, very detailed accounts of what they remembered their relatives having said. And so I had an enormous amount of input from the families. And then on top of that, beyond that, I had just hundreds of hours of plain old-fashioned, tedious, sitting in Suzuelo Library at Washington, poring over microfilmed clippings, news clippings, and things like that, just as assembling every detail of every part of the story. I write in chunks that I think of as scenes. And so like the Poughkeepsie race would be one scene. And so the way I write is I'd spend probably a couple weeks detailing everything about that race, whether I plan to use it or not. Everything every one of these boys said about it, everything that was written about it anywhere. I do things like I go to the U.S. Naval Observatory site and find out what time the sun rose that day in Poughkeepsie and what time it set, what phase the moon was in case that becomes relevant. So I just assemble every detail I can that it might be applicable, and then I write just that one scene. And I don't write it until I come to the point where I feel like it just has to come out of me. So basically, that's my process. Yes?
So that's an incredible story, and it must have been an incredible process. And there's so many great rowing stories. What's your next rowing book going to be about?
Yeah, I keep getting asked, particularly by my agent and my editors, what my next book is. And it may be another rowing book, you know? I mean, I've gotten so interested in it. I don't know. I'm casting around looking for ideas, frankly. You really have to love a story if you're going to spend 5 years researching it. It becomes your life for 5 years. And so I'm trying to find that story that I can fall in love with and spend that much of my life with. I'm always glad to get suggestions, though, from people. On my website, there is a contact form, which basically just sends an email to me. And I'm very much in a mode of collecting stories. Yes, sir.
Thank you. I haven't read your book, but we're in Philadelphia, the home of Kelly Drive and John B. Kelly. And sculling, does that figure in your book at all?
The Philadelphia scene doesn't particularly figure in the book. It does incidentally toward the end. There was some dispute over who was going to represent the United States in 1936. Very briefly, the Washington boys won the Olympic trials in Princeton and were told about 2 hours after they won the right to go to Germany, they were told that, oh, by the way, you have to pay your way. And they were flabbergasted. Nobody had told them that. And the university didn't have funds for them. None of these boys had two pennies to put together. So it looked as if they would not be able to go. And I believe it was Pennsylvania Athletic Club that came forward and said, oh, we have the money, and we finished second, so we will go. So that very night provoked a flurry of phone calls. Royal Brougham, the Seattle PI sports writer, and George Varnell from the Seattle Times, a number of other Seattle sports writers started making calls back to Seattle. And the phones rang all over Seattle that night. And by morning, they had put together a fun drive, and there were kids out on street corners literally with cups, and kids going around selling paper badges for 25 cents apiece, and people appealing to corporate sponsors and civic pride. Anyway, within 48 hours, they raised $5,000, which is what they needed. The money was wired. Meanwhile, Al Ulbrichsen had picked the team up and moved to the training facility at Traverse Island, so that nobody could tell him he couldn't go. So they wired the money to Traverse Island, and they were good to go. Yes, sir.
In your research, did you gain any insights from the perspective of the German rowers and what they experienced being handpicked and what happened to them after they lost?
Not really. I tried. I went to Berlin partway through the process, went to Grunau, which was fascinating. And I met a German gentleman there, Herr Philipp, who runs the Wassersports Museum right at the regatta grounds in Grunau. And he had very little English, and I have no German. But we tried very hard to figure that question out. We sat in an office together and pored through German books, we identified who the nine German kids in that boat were. Their names, their ages, who they rowed for. They rowed for a club called Viking. But that's about all we got on them. I know that one of them survived the war and became a quite well-known boat builder in Germany. Walter, I'm sorry, I can't remember his full name. But I don't know about the others, and I don't know how many of them survived the war. My guess is a lot of them didn't survive the war, but I don't know that for a fact. Yes, sir, in the middle.
Pretty much a follow-up on the same question, but what reaction have you had to your book from the Germans and from the Europeans who were also competed in that regatta?
Right. I haven't had any reaction yet, except that a large German publisher bought the book rights the same day that I sold them in the U.S., and actually pretty much every European country bought the book rights. So they're all interested in the story. How it plays in Germany, I'm not sure. I'm very interested. The German edition, I'm not sure when it's coming out. It hasn't come out yet, so I won't really know until that edition comes out. Yes, ma'am.
Your book seems like it would make a wonderful movie, too. What do you think about that?
I think it would make a heck of a movie. Actually, it is going. Apparently, going to the day after we sold the book rights to Penguin, we optioned the film to the Weinstein Company, which is the company that made The King's Speech and a number of other Oscar films. Actually, they didn't make that one. They distributed that one. But the Weinstein Company optioned the rights, and then about 6 weeks ago, they actually exercised that option and bought the rights outright. And my last understanding is they have a script in hand and they're moving forward. So cross your fingers, because you never know in Hollywood. But if they make a good film, and I think they do make good films. That's one reason we went with them. If they make a good, tasteful, stirring, uplifting film, I think it'll do great things for rowing. So hopefully that's in the works. Yes.
When they make the movie, the coxswain that plays Bobby Mock should be Seamus Labrum.
Oh, yeah?
He just graduated this month from Washington.
Oh, yeah?
And he's been a coxswain for the last 4 years, an NCAA champ every year.
I don't know his name. It's Seamus?
Seamus.
Okay. He's a varsity coxswain?
Yeah, he was in the eight that went to Henley when he was a freshman.
The kids at Henley?
They went undefeated then.
Yeah,
and I think they're beating the finals. That's the only race they've lost this year, I think.
The kids sent back from
South Jersey.
So, okay.
Yeah.
The Washington crew went to Henley recently. Sent me a video, a YouTube of all eight of them sitting around the boathouse in, or actually their lodgings in Henley, reading the book, getting ready for their race. So that was fun. Yes, sir, back there.
Do you intend your book to speak to the current generation of rowers?
Did I intend my book to speak to the current generations of rowers? Yeah, absolutely. The reality is, I've noticed traveling around the country that a lot of my readers are older, and those who aren't older are rowers. And oftentimes they are both, older and rowers. But yeah, absolutely. I'm very hopeful that the book. There's actually Penguin has a large academic sales unit, and they're going to, when the paperback comes out, they're actually going to be trying to sell it heavily into high schools as a common read, which I think would be great. Yes, sir. I can hardly see you in the back there, but.
I find myself sitting between two sisters who just purchased 10 of your books at full price.
Good girls.
And the reason they did is because their father's mentioning it. And there's a parallel story to your boat, the boat, Men in a Boat, in that their father was the winner of the bronze medal in 1936, a gentleman from Philadelphia.
Yes.
Who was bumped at the start of his race by a British boat.
Yes.
And managed to catch up and get the bronze medal. I wonder if you could. His name was Daniel Hubert Barrow, by the way. He was also a member of the Penn AC 8. Which,
yes.
In 1930,
I remember the name.
Cup,
yes,
wasn't allowed to row at Henley because they're Irish Americans. weren't allowed to row in 32 because the California boat was given the choice in the LA Olympics.
Really?
So he became a national singles champion, which is kind of unusual for a member of an eight. And he did, like I said, win the bronze in I forget which lane he was in. He was bumped by a British man at the start, but he won the bronze in 36 in Berlin. I wonder if you could say anything about him, since he's mentioned in your book.
I know the name, and I'm sorry, that's about all I know. But that's very interesting. Yes, in the same general vicinity back there.
I have a question about Leni Riefenstahl's film. Have you ever heard whether an improved version is going to ever be released?
You know, I think there may be an enhanced version out there. Does anybody know?
On Amazon, the reviews are very bad on the digitalized version.
Oh, okay.
And it has the 8 in it, and of course, as Dan, one of Dan Barrow's daughters, I'm hoping the singles is in it too. But the 8, they say it's hard to see.
Yeah, it's not very. It's hard. It is hard to see. Although I have to say that I'm no fan of Leni Riefenstahl as a person, but the rowing sequence is actually pretty compelling. I mean, I've been focused mostly on looking on that 8 sequence showing the 8s. And it's pretty compelling film. I mean, she intercuts long-distance shots of them progressing down the course with close-ups. She obviously put a camera in the boat after the race was over and had them re-row because she's got close-ups of Bobby Mock and Don Hume right in their faces as they're
right,
rowing.
Right, you say it in your book.
It's Pardon?
It's in your book. It's very... very descriptive how
right.
Described it well how she did it.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Right. So it's interesting to watch.
But you have yourself have never seen a good version of the film?
And not any better than everybody else, no.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
I'm fascinated with the history of the sport of rowing, and I'm just curious how you would generalize why people were so enraptured with the sport during that era.
Yeah, you know, I've wondered about that. And I mean, frankly, part of it is because there weren't so many other things competing for people's attention. You know, there was no Super Bowl Sunday and nonstop NBA coverage and Major League Baseball on every channel. I mean, there were just a lot fewer choices. And, frankly, I think that has a lot to do with it. But I think it's a shame. And, one of my hopes for the book is that it will help draw more people to regattas, and I think more people should be out there. But I don't know any reason, cultural reason, other than just that it was one of a relatively small number of options for spectator sports. People were very into it, though. Yes.
Has anything survived of George Pocock's shop?
I'm sorry, one more time.
Has anything survived of George Pocock's shop where he made the boats?
Yeah, actually, I snuck in there about, it's in the loft of the old shell house on the Washington campus, which is now used basically to store canoes and old derelict shells. But when the scriptwriter for the film was up a month or two ago, he and I snuck into it and went up into the loft, and it's still there. It's pretty much, you can actually see on the wall where Pocock wrote measurements and made calculations. They later moved to a different shop off campus. When his son Stan took over, I'm not sure when they moved exactly, but they ultimately moved off campus. But his shop's, the loft shop is still pretty much as it was then. Yes, ma'am.
Did Joe's daughter Judy receive any compensation or royalties or other than being recognized in the end of the book?
Judy receives 10% of what I receive, yeah. Yes.
I enjoyed your book very much. I had a question. When you were dialoguing with Joe Rance, how did you go about drawing him out?
I'm sorry, when I was...
talking with him?
Oh, yes. It was Judy that really helped draw him out, because Judy, like most of the offspring of these guys, had been carrying this story around with them for 70 years, and she knew the story. She knew her dad knew the story, so she was absolutely... instrumental. When I sat down with Joe, I always sat with Judy and Joe, and she knew the questions to ask. She knew what questions would provoke other questions and other answers. So Judy was an enormous part of this project, almost a co-writer, certainly a deep collaborator, and she really unlocked her father's story in particular for me. Yes.
This is kind of a little detail, but there was one part before they went to Germany where one of the boys finds out that he's of Jewish background and he was raised never knowing that. And then after the race, I never heard what happened. Was he able to meet with his relatives in Germany or?
I absolutely dropped the ball. I get this question every time. Just for those of you who haven't read the book, I don't think it's too big a spoiler just to tell you very briefly what the story is, which is that when they were in Traverse Island waiting to go to Germany, Bobby Mock, the coxswain, knew he had relatives in Germany and Switzerland. So he wrote to his father and said, can you send me their address? I want to visit them while I'm over there. And he waited and waited for a response and finally came an envelope. And he opened the envelope and there was another envelope inside and it said, open this in a private place. And so Bob went out into a field and sat under a tree and opened it up and learned for the first time that his whole ancestry was Jewish. He had not known that. And he actually cried when he found this out, not because he was bothered by being Jewish, but he was terribly pained by the fact that his father had felt that he had to keep that concealed from his own son. And I think we forget that there was still a lot of anti-Semitism in this country in the 20s and 30s. And Gaston Mock, Bobby's dad, just decided to not let his family know that, to have a different identity. So that really pained Bobby. So when they after the games, a number of them went bicycling around Europe, and Bob was part of that group. And all I know is that Bob disappeared from the main group for a few days and then reappeared and rejoined the group. Presumably he visited his relatives during that time, but he and his daughter, with whom I interviewed in great detail, didn't really know any more than that about it. His daughter didn't know any more than that about it. So presumably he visited his relatives during that time. Okay, one more. Yes.
Hi. I'm a new rower. I just started a couple years ago, and my dad gave me this book as a gift, like graduation and stuff. I'll be rowing in college. And I'm only a couple hundred pages into it, and I, like, cry every three pages. I'm not kidding. And I read, like, the race portion scenes, and I, like, can totally relate. Like, I've had one of those magical moments, and I just want to thank you, first of all. But I also want to ask, like, did you ever feel so compelled and so connected with the rowing and the story that you wanted to go row yourself? Like, have you ever given it a shot?
Sure. A couple things. First of all, yes, absolutely. I really, partway through this, I mean, I knew when I went into it, this was a problem that I didn't row. And it was my one real big hesitation about doing the project. And so it just really hasn't been an opportunity since then, but I do intend. I've told half of Seattle I'm going to learn to row, so they will run me out of town if I don't. And a whole bunch of coaches out there have come forward and said, free lessons, you know, just get yourself down to the Shell House. So I expect to do that. I just wanted to comment on the fact that you were crying over some of the book. I'm glad you told me that, because you are the first lady who has told me that. I get emails almost every day from men who tell me that the book has moved them to tears. And I was just beginning to wonder if there if I had somehow misconnected with women entirely, or if there's something about the male bonding experience. I don't know what it is, but I get a lot more guys saying that they shed tears over it than women so far, so that's just interesting to me. All right, well, thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.